Fancy a game?
I would hope you just explain math to them.
Well, like we're too self-referential.
Is that how analytics work?
I think I did my math right.
I do not trust your math at all.
Technically correct.
And people call us smug.
With Tyler Bischoff.
Hello, moral victories. We've got a lot on TJ Otzelberger already getting upset with the amount of close losses UNLV has. Plus, Golden Knights might be doomed. Like, not like the season's going to be a complete disaster, but I'm not really convinced they're going to actually be contenders for the Stanley Cup. The Raiders, though, I think they doomed their playoff chances. At least it kind of feels like it. They lost by 31 points to the Jets. Like, so they went to New York, and they were a three-point favorite. And we even talked about on Friday, like, there's a path for the Jets to win that game. They've got a good run defense, and they could force Derek Carr to beat them, and that's certainly plausible that it doesn't happen. It didn't happen. So losing to the Jets, I don't think, is that shocking. Losing 34-3 is like, what in the hell happened? Last year's team losing 34-3 would have been, what in the hell happened to the Jets? It's remarkable that they lost that bad to the Jets. That's their worst. Like, the Vikings, Packers, and Chiefs didn't even beat the Raiders that badly. 34-3. It's a disaster.
It was one of those games where you go back to rewatch it, and then halfway through the second quarter, I just basically was like, I don't need to do any analysis on this.
If you lose to the Jets by 30 points, you're eliminated from the playoffs. Automatically.
Yes. Doesn't, I like this.
Doesn't matter what happens the rest of the season. If you lose to the Jets by 30 points, you are automatically eliminated from the playoffs. You could be 15-1, but if you lost to the Jets by 30 points, it does not matter. That should be a rule in the NFL. The Jets' previous biggest win this year was by 17 points over the Redskins. 31 is almost double 17. Almost. Like, the Raiders were almost twice as bad as what the Jets did to the Redskins. Now, despite losing hilariously bad to the Jets, the Raiders are still in the playoff hunt. They're 6-5. They're still tied for the last wild card spot. And the good news is the wild card competition is not exactly good teams. The Pittsburgh Steelers might be starting, Devin Hodges?
Oh, man.
He took over for Mason Rudolph, won a game against the Bengals, and now he might be their starter. They're currently occupying the final wild card spot. That's basically what your competition looks like. So they're still in the playoff hunt. However, Football Outsiders, they've got odds for each team to make the playoffs at any given point in the season. And this tweet from Mike Trainer: the Raiders' playoff chances dove from 50.5% to 18.7%, according to Football Outsiders. The Browns and Steelers now have a better chance of making the playoffs.
Wow. All right. So, yeah, you're right. If you lose by 30 points to the Jets, we take away at least 30 points
from your chance to make the playoffs. The problem for the Raiders as far as making the playoffs and that loss to the Jets, regardless of how bad that loss to the Jets was, that was supposed to be one of the easy games on the schedule. And not that the Raiders have an extremely difficult schedule the rest of the way, but the next three games, they go to Kansas City this week, they're home against Jacksonville, they're home against Tennessee. Can they win two of those three? Because they kind of have to win two of those three to have a legitimate playoff shot. At Kansas City, the Chiefs aren't great right now, but it's still at Kansas City. Home to Jacksonville, they're starting to fall off, so that one seems like it's the most likely win, but can they beat Tennessee in Oakland? I don't know. Ryan Tannehill's like a top 10 quarterback in the NFL at the moment. So I don't know. Like, can they pretty much have to win two of those three to have a chance at the playoffs, because if they only win one, they're going to be 7-7 with two road games to close the year. Best case scenario, 9-7. There's a pretty good shot. 9-7 is not good enough to make the playoffs. So that loss to the Jets hurts, regardless of the score. Losing that game to the Jets hurts, and if you're a team with legitimate playoff expectations, which the Raiders are, like, I know at the beginning of the year we weren't, but the Raiders are. Like, you win three games in a row and you get to 6-4 and you're sitting here looking at, oh, we go and beat the Jets. We're 7-4 playing Kansas City for the division lead. Like, you absolutely have legitimate playoff expectations. To go lose in New York by 31 points is about as bad as it gets. Like, getting blown up by the Jets, like, that's nowhere near good enough. And now they have to make up for that somewhere. They can do it this week. If they go beat Kansas City, they're 7-4, they're 7-5, I should say, and it's like nothing ever happened. They just inverse the two wins they were supposed to have. And honestly, you'd rather have the win over Kansas City than the win over the Jets, because that win over Kansas City could help you actually win the division, whereas the Jets win wouldn't help you as much actually winning the division. But for the Raiders, the biggest problem they have right now, the offense is bad. The offense cannot score. We've been talking about it for a couple of weeks, where they go and play the Chargers, and because of a defensive touchdown and another interception that set them up in field goal position, the Raiders offense was only really responsible for 16 points against the Chargers. And then they play the Bengals, the worst team in the NFL, and they only put up 17 on the Bengals. And now they get you just 3 in an entire game against the Jets. Like, the last couple of weeks, the Raiders have survived. The Raiders have sort of masked their offensive issues with an unsustainable sack rate and an unsustainable turnover rate. The defense was basically creating the same amount of pressure the previous 2 weeks as they had the entire season. They were just at an unreasonable rate bringing the quarterback down. And they were forcing turnovers, where you get 5 in 2 games. If you have a really good defense, that's, you know, plausible. But if you're the Raiders, you don't have a really good defense. Everyone knows that. Getting 5 over the course of 2 games isn't going to continue to happen. And when that all stopped, it all fell apart. The Raiders' offense has been a problem because if they get knocked off schedule, they cannot score. They have been very good this season at avoiding third and longs, or even just avoiding third downs, period. Like, the Raiders have been good on first and second downs, to where they get a lot of third and threes, or they don't even face third down a lot. The Jets got the Raiders off schedule. The Jets shut down Josh Jacobs. He had 10 carries for 34 yards in that game. In the first half, Josh Jacobs had 1 carry that went for more than 3 yards. 1 carry for more than 3 yards. So that means, and they usually give Jacobs carries on first and 10. When they, pretty much every drive, all right, we're going to give the ball to Josh Jacobs. Best case scenario, it was 2nd and 7 in the first half. Best case scenario. First play of the game, he got hit for no gain. First play of the game, it was, here's a handoff to Jacobs. Okay, now it's 2nd and 10. Where do we go from here? And that's where they struggled. The Raiders came into that game top 5 in the NFL in stuff rate allowed. Only 15% of their carries had been hit for no gain or negative yards. The Jets, as we talked about, came in number 1 in that stat on defense. 34% of the time, they get the running back down in the backfield or at the line of scrimmage. That was the most important matchup. The Raiders lost that one. The Raiders' offensive line lost that game, which means they didn't have a running game, and which meant Derek Carr's got to go win the game for you. The passing game has to win the game, and the passing game was terrible. It wasn't all on Derek Carr. They had 3 drops in the first half that were guys just wide open, hit him in the hands, and yeah, we're just not going to catch this one. And it was 3 different guys. It was Renfrow, Tyrell Williams, and Jalen Richard. 3 different guys were just like, yeah, we don't have any interest in catching this one. So it wasn't all on Derek Carr, but Derek Carr was 15 of 27 for 127 yards. He threw a terrible pick 6 where they're in the second half down 3 scores and they come out their first play. Let's have 3 receivers run a 3-yard curl route.
Well, thankfully those aren't easy to jump.
One got jumped and returned for a touchdown. And that's why, like, this whole year we've talked about Carr and short passes, and it hasn't been as bad as in previous years. But I've said, like, it feels like some of this is also on Gruden. If you watch that play, there's 4 receivers in the route. 3 of them ran a 3-yard curl. Like, that's what John Gruden wants. Like, he wants a 3-yard curl. So it's not all on Derek Carr, but a lot of it is in that game.
I would also argue, though, again, they tried the whole air it out to Cooper, and then they had to trade Cooper, and they were like, okay, Derek Carr can't make these throws.
But he has been making them. He leads the NFL in completion or accuracy percentage beyond 20 yards.
I mean, you know, 1 of 2 is right. Still 50%.
You're right. It's not as many, but, like, he has been accurate when he throws the ball down the field. They just don't do it. He doesn't do it. The play calls usually aren't there for them to do it. Like, it's just, it's Carr and Gruden. They're both like, hey, we want these 3-yard curls, man. This is what we want to do. So if you look overall, Derek Carr, he threw 7 passes behind the line of scrimmage.
Oof.
He threw 6 passes that traveled more than 10 yards in the air. He only attempted 1 pass that traveled more than 20 yards in the air. Mike Glennon came in, threw 7 passes over the last quarter and change. He threw as many passes 20 yards in the air as Derek Carr did in that game. So that's the sort of problems with the passing game that you're seeing. You throw in 3 drops and Derek Carr having probably his worst game of the year, and it's not what it's going to be. And that's, if you look at this season and if you look at Derek Carr's career, that's what's been the problem with Derek Carr. His O-line this year, exceptional. His running back, excellent. So their running game has been awesome all season long. They don't face very difficult passing downs. Derek Carr's been put into good situations. He's got time to throw it, and he doesn't have to convert 3rd and 12s, right? The only real problem that the offense has is they don't have good wide receivers. They're relying on Hunter Renfrow to be the best wide receiver on the team. Like, Darren Waller's the best target for Derek Carr. That's the only real issue. He doesn't have a true, like, awesome option to throw the ball to. But for the most part, Derek Carr has been put into very easy, manageable situations, and he's excelled in that role. It's very similar to what he did when they went to the playoffs with 12 wins in 2016. They had a great offensive line. They ran the ball extremely well in that year. They had Amari Cooper and Michael Crabtree both have really good seasons. So when Derek Carr is put into situations with an excellent offensive line and a good running game, he's going to be a pretty good quarterback. When teams take that away, when his offensive line loses the battle, that's what he looks like. That's what his career has looked like when he doesn't have a great offensive line. Now, all quarterbacks need a good offensive line. Like, it's like, very rarely does Russell Wilson or Deshaun Watson happen. Like, there's not many guys that are doing what those have done in their careers where it's like, all right, I'm going to get sacked 12 times a day, but I'm still going to throw for 412 yards. Like, that doesn't happen a whole lot, but Derek Carr can't even do it when his offensive line is average. Like, his offensive line has to be top 5 in the league, or else that's what you get.
Oy.
By the way, Raiders now 1-4 on the road.
Well, okay. This season, as far as road is concerned, is sort of an aberration, because didn't they went 2 months without ever coming back home, and their only home game in that stretch was in London. Yeah. Do we count that as a...
No, that's a home win. Yeah, that's a home win.
Is it, though? Because it feels like a road win.
Yeah, it's a home win. The Bears were on the road, too.
All right.
Didn't they paint Raiders at midfield? That's all you need.
Okay.
Their only win came in Indy, where they got a pick 6. Colts didn't have T.Y. Hilton, and they won by 7. I'm curious, can they actually win road games? Because if they're going to make the playoffs, they're going to have to win some road games. They play Kansas City this week, and their last 2 are at L.A. and at Denver. They're going to have to win at least probably 2 of those 3 to have a legitimate shot at making the playoffs. And I don't know if they can win 2 of those 3 on the road. And then for this team, and this is, you know, I don't have really expectations of this team actually winning if they get to the playoffs, but if this team's going to do anything in the playoffs, they're going to have to do it on the road. Like, the Raiders are going to go into the playoffs if they make it as probably the 6th seed. They're going to be playing a division winner on the road. It'll probably end up being the Chiefs if they make the playoffs. Can they win in Kansas City in the playoffs? Probably not. Like, so I don't have much expectations for this team. I will say the losses this year on the road are to good teams before this one. It was Houston, it was the Vikings, it was the Packers. Like, those are all 3 teams that are going to probably make the playoffs. So they've played good teams on the road until this week, so it really hasn't been that issue. But the other problem is they get blown out on the road. Like, they lose to Houston by 3, but otherwise it's the Jets by 31, it's the Vikings by 20, and it's the Packers by 18. 5 road games this year, they're minus 65. That's with a win in there, too. So they're not even close in the road games. It's not like, oh, we just needed to make 1 more play. No, like, you needed to make 75 more plays. Everything needed to go differently in that game. So they've got 3 more road games. They got to win at least 2 of them, more than likely. I don't know that they can do that. And then even if they do, they got to go win in Kansas City in the playoffs. They haven't really shown that they can do that. Tenor the Correct, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Make sure you place your bets at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook all season long. Every Monday night, Bourbon Street Lounge will host football viewing parties with giveaways, including jerseys. It is Technically Correct, brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
Check out the podcast on lvsportsnetwork.com.
Visit the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook all season long.
Football enthusiasts can catch this year's games with a Monday night viewing party at Bourbon Street Lounge, with giveaways throughout the game, including jerseys. Plus, you can play Las Vegas' longest-running free football contest with $30,000 in guaranteed cash prizes each week. Or place your bets from your phone or tablet with the Be Connected Sports app. Download it at BeConnectedSports.com. Boyd Gaming has you covered for football season.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
Jet safety Jamal Adams was disrespected by Raiders fans.
Here is what Jamal Adams said after the game.
When we came onto the field, we felt disrespected. We got booed in our own home stadium by the Oakland fans, and we came back into this locker room, went out, and it was a hell of a talk. It was something that needed to be said. We felt disrespected, went out there, and put up a shut up.
Who said what? You said it needed to be said.
I'm not gonna get into what was said.
Oh, who said it?
We felt disrespected.
In pregame warm-ups.
Yeah, I came in here and sparked it off.
In pregame warm-ups, right? Yeah. You're talking about it? Yeah.
Was this worse than usual? There were some other games that the Cowboy fans were pretty loud too. Then.
Yeah, no, it's just, you know, I guess I don't want to sound very arrogant and just cocky, but, you know, they came in, I think they came in a little too happy. Just put it like that. I think they didn't. They thought it was just going to be an easy game. Put it like that.
Would you like to complain?
No.
You don't want to complain about the audio?
Oh, I would. I really would. But there's nothing anyone's ever going to do about it. I have learned. Everyone's just going to always have bad audio and not realize that some of us need to use this audio.
That was from the Associated Press.
Yep.
The gold standard of journalism.
Audio matters.
Nope. Doesn't matter to anybody. I found that interesting simply... Well, first off, when he says at the end, they came in a little bit too happy, do you think he was referring to Raiders fans or the actual Raiders?
I don't know if anyone who lives with John Gruden on a daily basis is what you would describe as happy.
So what I find interesting about that, though, is the way athletes and coaches, pretty much across all sports, the lengths they go to find a chip to put on their shoulder.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the amount, like, the best one, the Hall of Famer of finding a chip on your shoulder is number one seed or team favored to win the game says nobody believed in us. That's the Hall of Famer. And you're like, wait a minute. You guys are like 7-point favorites. What are you talking about? That's the Hall of Famer. This one, I don't know that I've ever heard this one before, where they go out for warm-ups and there's Raider fans at the stadium booing them as they take the field, and they're like, oh, hell no. We weren't going to try very hard today, but now.
We were all ready to just go play these last couple games, get on a plane to Tahiti, see who we draft, come back next year, try again. But no. Now we're playing hard.
You booed us in our stadium that we share with the Giants? Hell no. That is not allowed. Like, that's... I will always be fascinated at how players and coaches find things to motivate them. And this one is like... Never even heard this one before. Like, we expected to have a great home crowd advantage, but we didn't. So we had to go beat the Raiders down because their fans were too happy. And we can't have happy Raider fans in our stadium. It's just... It's amazing. And by the way, Jamal Adams needs to come play for the Raiders because next year in Las Vegas, it's going to work every game.
UNLV had 5 takeaways against San Jose State.
4 picks, 1 fumble recovery. Hell, 2 of the picks were by defensive linemen.
Yeah,
after passes were batted at the line of scrimmage. 5 San Jose State turnovers. The last time UNLV got 5 turnovers in a game was against Idaho State in 2016. The last time they did it against a Division I team was 2011 against Nevada. And in the last 2 games, UNLV now has 8 takeaways. They had 6 in the first 9 games of the season. They have 8 in the last 2. It's remarkable. It's unbelievable. Like, I don't even believe that it... I still don't believe that it happened. It's got to be... By the way, it's got to be frustrating for Sanchez that the last two games, his defense is, like, making plays, like, significantly changing games, and it doesn't matter because he can't go to a bowl game. Like, if he had had this at any point in his tenure before now, he might have had a bowl game. If they had just done this against Howard, they'd have gone to a bowl game. They didn't just do it once against Howard, and they go to a bowl game. So, like, the defense is good now? I don't know what to do with this information.
Off the top of your head, which I don't know why you would have this information off the top of your head, how many points per game are they giving up through this week with 1 week left to play?
It was 30-something, so still 30-something. Because yeah. They had five turnovers, still gave up 30 points.
Okay, but last year, had they had any two-game stretch where they either had five takeaways or gave up 14 points, they might have been like...
Yeah, they still won four games last year, and that was with Max Gillum leading them to one win in seven starts, or six starts, whatever it was for him. So, yeah, I mean, if at any point...
They might have won, like, or at least been second-ranked in the conference.
Right, like, had they gone to the Arkansas State game, had they forced, like, three turnovers in that game, they win. They beat Arkansas State, and they would have been, what, 3-1 at that point going into conference play? Now, granted, Armani Rogers' injury might have still just completely ruined that season because now Max Gillum's got to figure out how to win a game throwing 55 times, and that was never going to happen. But, yeah, it just you could go pick out random two-game stretches and say, all right, if they had eight takeaways over these two games, they'd be going to a bowl game.
Just now the defense gets good.
Kenyon Oblad ran for 23 yards on Saturday.
Is it possible that somebody running for 23 yards is a bigger deal than Charles Williams running for 186?
Oh, man, this is such a hard question because the fact that they were like, hey, you know what was really good? Giving Charles Williams a bunch of carries and that working, but also having a guy who might pull the ball. So there's, I have a mental duality right now, and I don't know how to answer this question.
Excellent job. Williams had a monster day, 27 carries. He had two third down conversions on that game-winning drive where it's the end of the game. You're driving down, and you're like, hey, we're still going to run the ball with Charles Williams. But Oblad pulled the ball on zone reads. Tony Sanchez was pumped about that because he said Oblad had not pulled the ball on his own read in three straight games leading into this one. So the primary play of UNLV's offense over the last four seasons has been the zone read. And since Kenyon Oblad's taken over, half of the zone read doesn't exist. He doesn't even attempt to run it. The quarterback run is not a part of it. And with Armani Rogers, that's been probably the biggest fear of a lot of defenses is, oh, the quarterback's going to pull it. For three straight games, the defense, they didn't have to worry about him pulling it. They knew he wasn't going to pull it. He pulls it in this game three times. He gets 23 yards. There's a scramble in there for some yardage as well. And it at least makes the defenses think. It at least makes them, oh, crap, that guy might actually pull it. That being said, if I'm Nevada, I don't care if Kenyon Oblad pulls it because his longest run was 12 yards. That is the worst-case scenario if he pulls it that he's going to run for 12 yards. I don't care. I'm still selling out to stop Charles Williams because that's what's going to make UNLV good.
Okay, but I guess my thoughts are selling out to stop Charles Williams at 186 yards. Good luck.
Yes, Nevada's better than San Jose State of defense.
Okay.
It's
120 yards.
I mean, Charles Williams hasn't had that many good games since Oblad started.
Armani Rogers played two snaps.
Kenyon Oblad had his head bounce off the turf, got up a little bit slow. Refs made him leave the game. I don't even think UNLV checked him out on the sideline. But Armani Rogers came in, handed the ball off to Charles Williams twice.
That's a hell of an accusation.
I mean, we can see him come off the field, stand on the sideline, and watch the last two plays. UNLV scored after two handoffs. Normally, not a noteworthy occurrence. Quarterback gets knocked out for a couple of plays because his helmet comes off or something. Backup has to go in. But that completely eliminates any chance that Armani Rogers could have gotten a medical redshirt. I doubt he would have gotten it prior to that, but it's completely dead now because he played in a game in the second half of the season. And it's a little bit strange that he was the backup and not Max Gillum. I kind of thought a situation like that, where you're not pulling Oblad because of his performance, where he's got to come off because of a ref says so. You'd put in Max Gillum to hand the ball off twice, but they put in Armani Rogers. So his career wasn't over.
Maybe Max just doesn't have that crisp handoff.
Is that what it is? He struggles at the handoff?
And long passes.
Bishop Gorman lost to Liberty 30-24.
A streak of 10 years where Bishop Gorman won 10 straight state titles ended at Liberty High School on Friday night. Ray Brewer wrote a story in The Sun about it. The best part of it is the quote from Liberty's coach who said, "Everything we have done was to beat Bishop Gorman." I love the idea of it doesn't matter who else we play. We are simply trying to beat Bishop Gorman.
We are spent. We've accomplished our goal for the season. Whatever we do next is gravy.
That's the funny part, is they beat Gorman just to get to the state semis. They have to win two more games to be state champs. So if...
Don't need it.
If Liberty loses, are they state champions still?
I mean, I think so, yeah. I think they get the UCF...
Mythical championship?
Yeah,
I think so, too. Like, I think what we'll remember is, hey, Bishop Gorman lost to Liberty, and not whatever it is, Bishop Minogue from Reno beat Desert Pines or whoever it ends up being in the state title. I think we're going to remember, Liberty beat Bishop Gorman.
Man.
That's the important part. Coming up.
Okay, I was just going to make, never mind.
Bad coming joke. Up, you're going to want to hear TJ Altzberger. He was as fiery as he's ever been after the loss to SMU.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Tyler Bischoff is
the dumbest smart person I have ever met in my life.
Technically Correct.
TJ Altzberger is done with moral victories. UNLV is now 2-5. They have had four close losses to decent teams. One blowout loss to UCLA. Those close losses, 4 points to SMU on Saturday, overtime to Kansas State, overtime to Cal, and a 7-point loss to Texas State. Yes, Texas State is a decent team. They're not good, but they're top 150 in KenPom. So they are legitimately, 7 points away in regulation from being 5-2 with wins over Cal, K-State, and SMU. That'd be pretty good. People would be jacked for the TJ Altzberger era if they were 5-2 with those wins. But they're not. They keep losing close games. Here is TJ Altzberger's opening statement after the postgame, or after the loss to SMU in postgame.
We're done with moral victories. Our guys played hard. We didn't play winning basketball when it came time to win. That's on me. We're going to get it right. I don't care if I don't sleep in the process. That's not good enough, and it's going to get better here fast.
Did I oversell that?
What do you mean?
In the moment when he gave that, and I'm sitting there in the press conference, it felt much angrier than it just sounded.
I don't know. Whenever I watched it later, I like got chills.
Okay, so maybe I did. I don't know. Just re-listening to it, it didn't sound as fiery as I remembered it.
I think a lot of it was his face, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. That is normally opening statements are like, well, we played blah, 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 and they sort of just ramble on about the game. This was very much this is the message I want to send after this game.
I don't know. This is the message that I think there's a lot of fans that wanted to hear the coach finally emote and go, trying hard isn't enough.
So do you think that was a message to the fans?
I want to say yes.
Because I feel like it is in some regard, because that's been a small narrative of this season so far, is sort of the idea of moral victories and, hey, they've lost close games to decent teams and it's not even supposed to be a good year for UNLV, so that's a good sign. And he's saying, hey, that's not we're not happy with that. I almost think it's a message to himself, especially because he says, I'm not going to sleep until it's fixed. I almost think it's a message to himself where he's like, yeah, we're not going to have moral victories. Oh, crap. I'm the one that has to make sure we don't have moral victories. Like, I almost think that's where it is, where, like, he knows that even this year where there's not high expectations, he knows you can't sell moral victories. He knows you can't say, well, we lost by three. to that team that made the NCAA tournament. Like, he knows that is not going to work, and that's going to quickly wear out your welcome if you continue, if that A, continues to happen on the court, and B, you're viewed as like okay with that, even if you probably should be okay with that.
I mean, maybe he should in a, like, in a vacuum, thinking logically, but hearing a lot of his halftime conversations with Steve Cofield, the man has no voice at halftime because he is I think he hates losing.
So is that the problem? So he can't give good halftime speeches because he lost his voice?
No. What I'm saying is I think he is so angry at himself that anytime they're in these situations that, like, what we just got is the toned down version of what he just yelled at himself in the mirror. Like, you're not a loser! Stop coaching like a loser! Okay, no more moral... Yeah, all right. That's a more normal way, so I don't seem like an insane person.
Here's my potential issue, is I think he might have gone to that too early in the season. And basically what I mean by that is, how many times can a coach... If we assume he gave a similar type of speech in the locker room to the players, how many times can a coach go into the locker room and say, no more moral victories? How many times can he go into a press conference and tell the media and fans, no more moral victories? Like, you can't really do that a lot. Like, that he said it. It has to stop. It has to stop at some point. Like, at some point in the future, it has to stop, or else they're going to keep getting moral victories, and what's he going to say after? Like, you can't come in after every press conference and say, no more moral victories, because we're going to be like, this is the seventh time you've said that. And I think the problem is they're probably going to have a lot of more moral victories. They're going to have a lot more close losses this year because, A, they're not that good. They're not good enough to actually win a bunch of games. But B, they're not awful. Like, they're not going to get blown out by a lot of teams. And because they're playing relatively slow this year, a lot of the losses are going to be close. And so I think they're going to have a lot more moral victories. And so what happens when they're going to, well, they play Jackson State Tuesday. They should win that game. Jackson State's not any good. But they're going to play Cincinnati on Saturday. And then they play Fresno State and BYU in early December. What happens if you lose two of those three games by 2 points? Right?
You come into the press conference and you throw a chair and you say, this is on me.
Right. He started that escalation too early. Too early. This needed to happen in January.
No.
So the chair throwing comes at the very end of February.
No, you get it in now so that you have to keep escalating.
Well, by the time we get to February, he's going to force me and Mike Romala to fight each other in a press conference. Just
throws a Bowie knife in between.
Yes. So, I don't know. It seems like he went to it too early because as much as he wants to fix it, I don't know that he can really prevent this team from losing close games, because I think they're going to be in a lot of close games against decent teams, and they're going to end up losing more of them. And we're going to look back to, oh, well, after you lost SMU, you said no more moral victory. So what now? So, yeah, we'll see. We'll see. However, I think he should, like, he shouldn't say it publicly, but I think he should be okay with moral victories. At least I kind of am. Like, this year, they're not going to the NCAA tournament. The actual win-loss record isn't all that important. Like, you don't have to build a resume for anything. The way the team plays is more important. And, like, you absolutely can pick out, hey, end of games, they've been bad. And that's something that you want to see improve, absolutely. But the actual results aren't all that important this year. You're not going to go promote them and say, oh, overtime loss to Kansas State. But that actually is kind of a good thing for where the program is. Now, the game itself against SMU, I thought the first half was the worst they've played all season. They were terrible, both ends of the floor. Their biggest problem defensively was overhelping bad rotations. They made it a point to overhelp, like that seemed to be the scheme in that game, but the rotations and the recovery behind the double teams or the overhelping were terrible. They were awful, and that's where you get beat giving up open threes and open driving lanes. And ultimately, the defense is lacking good players, so they're going to have to overhelp a lot of times. They've got to figure out how to not get lost when rotating and recovering behind it. Like, we've seen it a few times this year where they don't do a good job recovering. Now, I don't know that Otzelberger can play less aggressively. I think you kind of have to continue that because the The whole goal of that is to give up less layups. You just have to figure out the communication behind it, and the defense will be better, but they don't have great one-on-one defenders. So help side defense is always going to be necessary. To me, though, the bigger problem is still offense. UNLV, worst game of the season as far as dribble penetration goes. They couldn't get to the rim. The first half, they attempted 5 layups.
Did they at least make them?
No. They had shot first half 5 layups, 5 mid-range jumpers, 17 threes. Like, they could not get to the rim at all. And Amori Hardy, his worst game at getting to the rim. Because normally this year, they have a hard time against Kansas State. They have a hard time against UCLA or whatever it is. Hardy's still able to beat guys off the dribble and get to the rim. He couldn't do it in this game. And he took 12 threes as a result of that. 12 of them. So Hardy couldn't do it one-on-one or off ball screens. The motion offense could not get anything going into the paint. SMU was sagging off a little bit, so they were giving up threes and making it much harder to dribble and drive. So UNLV ultimately in this game, 12 layups and dunks. They made 4 of them.
Oh, man.
Both of those numbers are terrible. You can't have a game where you only get 12 layups or dunks unless you get fouled on every possession and everything's a free throw. But to only have 12 layups or dunks is terrible. To only make 4 of them, awful. And Otzelberger, he did make an adjustment in the second half where they started posting up Mbaki Zhang and Donnie Tillman to sort of create artificial paint touches because they couldn't do it with the guards driving. They couldn't do it with Donnie Tillman driving. So they were like, all right, let's try to work some post touches here, and that'll get the ball in the paint. And they got Mbaki, first play of the second half, Mbaki Zhang made a little turnaround hook shot in the paint. That was good. And then they actually got some kick-out open threes off of that. But at the end of the day, they're not – post-ups, A, are very inefficient, and B, Tillman and Zhang aren't good enough. Like, if you actually go back to last season when Otzelberger was at South Dakota State, they ran a ton of post-ups. Mike Dom was their best player. He was a center. They threw it to him in the post when he'd get a short guy on him, and he'd turn and score. So, like, they absolutely – like, Otzelberger can make post-ups work. They can be efficient, but you've got to have, A, a really good offensive piece there, and B, a good matchup. And Mbaki Zhang's not efficient enough, and I don't think Donnie Tillman's ever posted up more than like 10 times in his life. So neither one of those are going to be great like long-term options. And in this game, Tillman was 0-for-4 at the rim. Zhang was 2-for-4 at the rim. So neither one of them is going to finish very good. And then neither one of them is like a great passer. Tillman, when he got doubled in the post in that game, dribbled backwards, which is, it's not the worst thing you can do, right? A turnover is much worse. He didn't turn it over. But when you get doubled, you'd like to see them, all right, we're going to cut up your defense now because you just left somebody wide open. Neither Tillman nor Zhang are good enough to really hurt defenses that way. So post-ups are not going to be some cure-all for this team, but it is a decent change of pace to throw in there, especially if you play a team where Zhang's got like a 6'6 guy on him or Tillman's got an actual guard on him. There's a chance there where you've got a good enough matchup where they can either score against it one-on-one or you force a double team and hopefully the passing gets a little bit better. But I thought offensively that was their worst game. However, they ended up 1.1 points per possession. It was actually a fairly efficient offensive game. 3 reasons. 1, they got a lot of offensive rebounds, so they got some second chance points. 2, they got a lot of free throws in that game, which is good. And then 3, they made their threes. Like that, they actually hit 36% of their threes in that game. So they ended up with a decent offensive night overall, but it was terrible as far as what they're trying to accomplish is, hey, we're going to run continuity ball screen and it's going to get somebody going downhill for a layup. That didn't happen. All right, let's see if Amori Hardy can beat his man off the dribble. That didn't happen either. So what they actually want to accomplish on offense didn't happen. It was more of, hey, we've got to settle for this 3. And they actually made some of them, so it was actually pretty good.
All right, so what's the plan going forward?
Post-ups!
Yay.
They're going to watch some film on Marvin Minzie's offense and start implementing it.
Oh, good God.
You ready?
Am I?
For Marvin Minzie's offense.
No.
It's coming to save the season. Coming up, I'll tell you why another disappointing end to the season for the Golden Knights is seeming more and more likely.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler.
They had a twist on it.
They did.
A twist, and it's
turned it around.
We should have thought of that.
We were so.
But it's still a stupid.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever.
Yeah, it's just clever. A turnabout.
Tyler Bischoff is technically correct.
When is Hanukkah?
22nd.
What's the last day, though?
30th.
That's what we care about, right?
Yes.
Okay. Golden Knights are currently in a playoff spot right now. They're in the last wild card spot. But they got beat at home by the Edmonton Oilers. And Edmonton then won again on Sunday. Edmonton is now 9 points ahead of the Golden Knights. The Golden Knights do have a game in hand, but even if they were to win that game in hand, it's still a 7-point gap, which is equivalent to 4 games. I guess my question, regular season-wise, for the Golden Knights, is winning the division still the goal or even the expectation? Like, they were projected to win the Pacific Division at the start of the year. Dom Lucchesin of The Athletic had them, I think it was 45% for them to win the division. So far and away better than any other team in the Pacific. There's still 57 games left. There's still a lot of time to catch Edmonton. There's still a lot of time for Edmonton to crash back down to earth. There's still a lot of time for the Golden Knights to go on an actual run and win more than 2 games in a row during this season. Both will probably happen at some point. Golden Knights will probably have some 10-game stretch where they win 9, and Edmonton will probably have a 10-game stretch where they lose 9. So it's probably going to happen, but that might not be the only reason that you catch them. The problem for the Golden Knights, though, Edmonton is the only one they have to catch. Vancouver's third in the Pacific. They're 2 points ahead of Vegas. Game in hand for Vancouver. Arizona, 5 points clear of Vegas. So catching Edmonton, slightly difficult, but can happen. Catching Vancouver shouldn't be too hard. Arizona, very possible. But catching all three, that might be an issue. Plus, the Sharks are a point behind Vegas with a game in hand. Calgary's a point behind Vegas right now. You've got to catch Edmonton, Arizona, and Vancouver and hold off San Jose and Calgary. Anaheim's kind of around, too. I don't know that you can do all six of those. Like, I don't know how plausible it is that you'll accomplish all six of those.
Doesn't matter. What you do is you get into third, and then just ride that for 30 games.
Like, winning the division doesn't really matter. Like, it's not that important to win the Pacific. It's much more important that you get in the playoffs and you have a good matchup in the first round. Probably even more so than home ice is that you have a good matchup in the first round. So winning the division isn't that important of a goal, but if we're already sort of adjusting regular season expectations, what does it mean about our expectations for this team in the playoff? Like, are we going to get to a point in the playoffs where it's like, well, they lost in the first round, but they were a wild card team and they had to play the number one team in the West? Like, because that's not good enough. The only measure of success for this team is winning the Stanley Cup now.
Yeah, like, you don't go all in on your cap space and go, well, you know, we were just trying to make the playoffs.
Yeah, like, that's not what this team is about. The last 2 years, sure. Like, the first year, absolutely. And even last year, I could buy the argument of, okay, we made a trade for Mark Stone at the deadline, but, you know, wasn't that big of a disappointment. Now, though, it is winning the Stanley Cup. That is what's important. This is probably a bad stat to use in the NHL because of how much change there is in the standings, but right now, Golden Knights 10-4-2 against teams outside the playoffs, 1-6-2 against teams in the playoffs. 1 win in 9 games against teams currently in the playoffs. The Golden Knights, they've been one of the bigger disappointments in the NHL. They just lost 7 of 8, but then they got 2 wins. Toronto and Calgary, 2 teams also extremely disappointing. Toronto fired their coach afterwards. Kind of looked like, hey, maybe the Golden Knights are back. They snapped a losing streak. It's going to be okay, and now they've lost 2 in a row again. Both in the Pacific Division, too. Sort of those have been their de facto wins is, hey, Golden Knights are going to win games in the Pacific Division. So are we sure the Golden Knights are good?
Didn't they do this last year with playoff teams?
Yeah, it wasn't this extreme. I'd have to go look it up again. It wasn't 1-6-2 bad like they are right now, but there was definitely a case of last year they weren't good.
Are the Golden Knights Kirk Cousins?
Maybe. Possibly. Isn't he just bad on national TV?
And he's not great against teams with winning records.
Okay. So, okay, the Golden Knights are Kirk Cousins. I can work with this. Because I don't think they can beat anyone in the playoffs. Like, and once you get to the playoffs, you got to beat a good team 4 times in a row. They almost did it last year, but they didn't. My big picture question on the Golden Knights is, have they shown us anything this year to basically prove they're different from last year? Where they were the third seed in the Pacific, they struggled against playoff teams, and once they got to the playoffs, they couldn't finish it off. Fun fact, the one playoff win this year for the Golden Knights, Jake Bischoff was in the lineup.
Can't play hot as shit.